this week's program, a conversation with landscape architect Kim Wilkie. He's the designer of Longwood Gardens' new East Conservatory Plaza. Opening ceremonies are beginning right about now in Kennett Square. Jane Pepper explores the Threepenny Opera. The Arden Theatre in Philadelphia is presenting its production of the classic 1920s-era Brecht and Weill musical. Susan Lewis considers different approaches to environmental art with a visit to the Schuylkill Centre in the Roxburgh section of Philadelphia. And we speak with Krishna Tyagarajan, the new president of Camden's Symphony in C. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Beginning today, visitors to Longwood Gardens will have access to a new outdoor plaza that will serve as both a venue for lectures and events, as well as a place for visitors to sit and relax. Similar to an amphitheatre, the Eastern Conservatory Plaza is an entirely grass-covered, terraced, curved landform seamlessly integrated into the landscape. The real gem of this new plaza, however, lies beneath the surface. Hidden within the form is a restroom complex which is surrounded by the largest living or green wall in North America. The wall itself is made of organic panels in which plants like orchids and holly ferns grow horizontally. All of this is the creation of UK-based landscape architect Kim Wilkie. Wilkie had an intense introduction to his chosen profession. The son of a British military attaché, read secret agent, he grew up in the Malaysian jungle and the deserts of Iraq before being sent to school in England. He studied history at Oxford and environmental design at Berkeley before founding his own landscape studio in London in 1989. Since then, his practice has forged a reputation for bold new designs in complex settings. Among his high-profile projects are the gardens at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, a restoration and management plan for New York University, as well as projects at World Heritage sites in Transylvania and the Russian Arctic Circle. I spoke with Kim Wilkie at Longwood Gardens and first asked him to describe his work there.
Longwood have created a whole new entrance plaza to their conservatory complex, and the challenge was to make something that blended with the landscape and the landforms and welcomed visitors in both from the entrance and the visitor centre and directed them from the conservatory down into the gardens. So what we've ended up with is a very sinuous, curving, sculptural landform which works with the trees and the forest behind and has a south-facing, cupped curve that directs people down to the rest of the gardens. And also from the very top you can see the fountain garden and the topiary garden. So it's a nice high vantage point that looks back to the conservatory and the rest.
How quickly did the form suggest itself to you when you first approached the project?
Surprisingly quickly, because there's not a lot of space at the end of the conservatory there. It dips down into the old Doe Run, which was the road through Longwood. And in a short space, you have to deal with a very large and significant building and then curve it south very quickly. And at the same time, we also had to fit in a new building, a restroom complex. So we tucked that under the landform. So you get this very curving, sinuous landform with a curving, sinuous restroom underneath.
And as you enter the restrooms, you come across perhaps the masterpiece of the entire project, what will be the longest green wall in the United States. I think a lot of people are familiar with green roofs, maybe not so much green walls. What are they and what purpose does it serve in this context?
The idea was to tuck the whole complex underneath the landform, but to make it top lit so the light comes in from up above. And because it's coming from a conservatory and Longwood have all the expertise of horticulture, the idea was then to clad the walls in orchids and ferns and green plants so that they're growing out of the walls. And you have this huge, long, continuous green serpentine jungle. And then you step through the jungle into each little restroom pod.
But to be very clear, these are not creeping plants or...
No, they're actually sitting in soil that's attached to the wall.
When did you first develop an expertise, because I gather you have some significant expertise in this area?
Strangely enough, I grew up in Malaysia, where orchids and ferns grow out of tree trunks and out of vertical faces. So it's something that I've always had a fascination with. And it's It's a way of turning what can be a rather humdrum functional space into something much more exciting.
Much of your work is done in the UK. You're coming to different climate, different growing conditions, and this green wall is also inside. Tell us about some of the challenges about plant selection and what was going to go into this wall.
In some ways, it being inside is an advantage because it's like an extension of the conservatories. The climate is controlled, and Longwood have fantastic expertise in plants. So it is a mixture of plants that like to grow in vertical crevices with extra cover to make sure it's completely green. But it's really been drawing on Longwood's star expertise in this area.
A shame the only time people are going to get to see it, though, is when they go to the bathroom.
They do that rather a lot.
How would you like visitors to use this space? Because, as you say, it's part entryway, it's part performance space. It's doing a lot of things.
And actually, because it is sinuous and curves up and works with the rest of the landform and the gardens, it's about flowing through it, but also the curves make little eddies off it. So I hope that there'll be times when it's just one person sitting there peacefully in the evening sun, and other times when there are 1,500 people enjoying a piece of music. So it has to be very flexible. It's an entrance, but it's also a place just to rest and be on your own.
And just a final question, how much did the design of this change from the time you walked into the space, as we discussed, and had a concept of what the final product, so to speak, might be? How much did it change as you designed it, as it evolved?
Remarkably little, actually. Technically, we've drawn on some really very good people, and the local landscape architects, Wells Appel, and the architects at FMG have made the concept really work on the ground. Longwood has been deeply involved, and Bancroft, the construction people, have really made what's an extremely challenging technical series of elements work very well.
And are there plants in any part of this that are unique to this region?
In the landform itself, outside, we've very much taken the native plants, the tulip poplars, the sweet gums, sugar maples, hemlocks, just to make the idea of that natural woodland come right up to the conservatory, make it feel as though it's been carved out of the space and embraced by the space. The other thing is that we've also worked by burying the restrooms underground. It insulates them so they get less hot and need less energy to cool them or to heat them. And we're harvesting all the rainwater from the conservatory roofs, reusing the grey water. So ultimately, I hope it's a 21st century sustainable building that's hidden within a sculptural landform.
Landscape architect Kim Wilkie. The new Eastern Conservatory Plaza at Longwood Gardens in Kennett Square opened just a few minutes ago. To mark the opening, Longwood is hosting a series of special events and tours highlighting the environmental aspects of the project until 4 this afternoon.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Although set in Victorian London, the roots of the Threepenny Opera are in 1920s, pre-Nazi era Berlin. While called an opera, it's actually an early example of what we today call musical theatre because it contains spoken as well as sung dialogue. With lyrics by Bertolt Brecht and music by Kurt Weill, the show has undergone several transformations over the years. Now, WRTI's Jane Pepper considers the history, evolution, and a current production of the Threepenny Opera at the Arden Theatre in Philadelphia.
Oh, the shark has pretty teeth, dear, and he shows them pearly white.
Mack the Knife is one of the 20th century's most recorded songs, with versions by Frank Sinatra, Ella Fitzgerald, and even the rock group The Doors. This song has transcended its origins, but it almost didn't make it into the Threepenny Opera. A few days before the 1928 Berlin opening, lead actor Harold Paulson threatened to quit if his character wasn't introduced with a big musical number. Paulson played McHeath, a thief and murderer who is as charming as he is dangerous. He marries the young and beautiful Polly Peachum, whose parents aspire to respectability. This conflict between depravity and bourgeois sensibilities drives the Threepenny Opera's narrative. The history of this musical is checkered. Commissioned for the opening of a new theatre in Berlin, the Threepenny Opera was performed more than 4,000 times by 1933. Arden Theatre producing artistic director Terry Nolan says that was the year it fell out of favor.
Ultimately, the Nazis banned Threepenny as part of their movement against degenerate art, and so famously, banned the production from being done in Germany.
Composer Kurt Weill fled to Paris, then moved to the U.S. The same year it was banned in Germany, an English adaptation opened on Broadway but closed after 2 weeks. More than 20 years later, a new softened adaptation opened to acclaim off Broadway and ran for 7 years.
Observe McKeith, the lethal kind of charmer. You wouldn't think a chink was in his arm.
Mary Martello, who plays Mrs. Peachum in the Arden production, says the show exposes hypocrisy, a universal human failing.
Everybody thinks they're better than somebody else, and the cops think they're the good guys, and the crooks are the bad guys, and everybody clings to their identities and their belief systems so strongly so that they can be right, other people can be wrong, or they can be better than other people.
Mrs. Peachum's daughter embodies opposites, says Victoria Frings, who plays Polly Peachum at the Arden.
She is both a woman who is raised to be perfect, like the perfect wife, and have excellent manners, and be everything her parents couldn't be. But at the exact same time, she was raised by very hardened people who were very aware of the difficulties of the world they live in.
Music director Eric Ebengay says tension also exists in the music itself, with pretty melodies and not-so-pretty lyrics.
The Cannon Song is certainly one of the great songs from the show. This is the song that McKeith and Tiger Brown sing. It's actually kind of a horrible song lyrically. It's very violent and kind of racist. But that's sort of one of the great things about the show, is that the lyrics of the songs are at odds often with the music. It's the kind of song you'd want to go out singing in the streets, but really can't.
John is a goner and Jimmy's gone.
And Georgie is 6 foot under.
But their memory will linger on.
When the cannonballs roar like thunder.
While the 1950s off-Broadway production softened the story and lyrics, the Arden has chosen to stage an adaptation that brings back some of the harsher elements, including Mrs. Peachum's Ballad of Sexual Imperative, a song removed also from the 1928 Berlin production.
But that's the sexual imperative.
The Arden has reintroduced this ballad in an attempt to include as much of Brecht and Weill's social commentary as possible. From pre-Nazi Germany to the present day, the telling of the story of the Threepenny Opera has been adapted, moderating social commentary to the sensibilities of the times. At the core of this musical is a good story, great tunes, and a fascination with the ability of rascals to charm us.
Still, he's evil, he's a murderer, and they haven't caught him yet.
WRTI's Jane Pepper. The Threepenny Opera is at the Arden Theatre in Philadelphia through November 7th.
And they haven't caught him yet.
The John S. and James L. Knight Foundation supports WRTI and invites listeners to dream big and submit their best idea for the arts to the Knight Arts Challenge Philadelphia. Inspired by the momentum of the city's steadily rising art scene, the Knight Arts Challenge is a 3-year, $9 million funding initiative. The contest is open to anyone, and there are just 3 rules. The idea is about the arts, the project takes place in or benefits Philadelphia, and applicants find funds to match Knight Foundation's grant. Grant application and information online at knightarts.org.
This is Creatively Speaking on WRTI. I'm Jim Cotter. Environmental issues, from the safety of drilling for oil and natural gas to a homeowner's choice of what light bulb to buy, are today topics of mainstream discussion. So-called environmental art dates from the land or earth art movement of the late 1960s, when artists created sculptures from natural materials in the landscape. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis considers the intersection of environmentalism and contemporary art with a visit to the Schuylkill Center for Environmental Education in the Roxburgh section of Philadelphia.
It could be a room-size earth drawing of a Buddha made by gently pushing pine needles into an outline on the forest floor, or two gleaming metallic robotic birds, each spinning on a post, their chirping driven by the light of the sun, a sculpture of branches and twigs tied together in the shape of an arc, which also functions as a deer fence, or a startling digital photograph of a gloomy-looking rhinoceros sprawled along the floor of a subway car. What is called environmental art today encompasses many forms of expression. Amidst a chorus of cicadas in a northwest Philadelphia woodland, Jane Ingram Allen, curator of Going Green, a traveling exhibition of environmental art by artists from Taiwan, which passed through Philadelphia this summer, defines the genre broadly.
Any art that the artist intends to either help the environment or raise a public awareness about environmental issues.
Environmental art can be something biodegradable that disappears over time, or more permanent. Both kinds of works are in evidence at the Schuylkill Center for Environmental Education in the Roxborough section of Philadelphia, where Mary Salvante is the advising director for the art program. The center, which strives to make people more aware of environmental issues, has found that art is a good way to do it.
The art is one way to create dialogue and present a thought-provoking installation to stimulate dialogue about an environmental issue.
While the public is the ultimate participant, the conversation at the Schuylkill Center begins between the artists and environmental scientists. What is aesthetically pleasing may not be environmentally sound. Salvante points to an invasive species, the bittersweet vine, as an example.
It has very lyrical and whimsical characteristics. The bark and the tree limbs curl and twist and make all of these unusual shapes and configurations. Most artists love that, but then they learn that it's invasive. And it grows up into the trees and it chokes the leaf and weakens the trees.
Although the Schuylkill Center has a small indoor gallery, its wooded surroundings are its primary exhibition space, where care is taken not to disturb the natural habitat.
And what is not often realized is that works that are too brightly colored can distract animals in a non-natural way, or if there are pieces that have a sound component that are not within a certain volume, that can also be disturbing to animals that might be in the midst of migration or, you know, their natural cycles of life.
The woods of the Schuylkill Center are now home to two site-specific installations created by artists from Taiwan.
My name is Chao Chang.
I'm Ping Yu Pan.
They are among the artists represented in the traveling exhibition Going Green. Curator Jane Ingram Allen says she wanted to demonstrate the different perspective of environmental artists from Taiwan.
Their use of materials is different, their whole philosophy, myth, religion. It's a cultural exchange, as well as an exchange about environmental issues.
Deep in the woods is a pine grove, where the pine needles and the earth have replaced the green underbrush. Artist Chow Chang Li has created on the forest floor a large outline in the shape of a giant Buddha. He calls his work, Everything is Buddha.
You know, this is a sort of sacred place, and you feel like this is almost a cathedral. You look up into all these branches and, you know, this sort of clearing, and he wants people to get that feeling from his work.
Nearby, artist Ping Yu Pan has created out of twigs and sticks Ark for Plants, a boat-like structure that surrounds a newly planted tree, protecting it from the deer.
The center has a problem with the deers eating the young trees. So I think that I want to protect the native species here.
In contrast with these installations created out of natural materials is an exhibition called Elemental Energy, Art Powered by Nature. As we walk along one of the Schuylkill Center's eight trails, we encounter art that is part of the landscape and yet not, as in the snake-like string of bright yellow shapes suspended above our heads, which undulates in the wind. Mary Salvante says the art heightens awareness of the natural environment.
It's such a stark contrast to what's around us, this brightly yellow series of petals. It really helps you to see actually the natural environment better when it's contrasted against something so opposite.
There are also sculptures called solar thumpers mounted on tree trunks along the trail. On each thumper, a solar-powered mallet rises and falls against a hollow wooden box onto which an opening is carved. Think of the body of a guitar or violin. As sunlight filters through a canopy of leaves, the gentle sounds come from a tree here, a tree there, like soloists in a cicada symphony. The goal? Perhaps to ornament a walk through the woods, most definitely to catch our attention.
Artists cannot really change the world. All they can do is raise some awareness.
Environmental art defies easy definition, created from the landscape or deliberately set against it, using natural materials, recycled or other man-made objects, or the latest technology. Decorative or utilitarian, it may be an object that will last or something that will disintegrate over time. In each case, environmental art aims to alter our perceptions, prompt reflection, and stimulate change.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Camden Symphony and C, formerly the Haddonfield Symphony, appointed a new president this summer. Krishna Tyagarajan began his tenure in September and will be at his first subscription concert this evening at the ensemble's home at Rutgers Camden Centre for the Arts. Of German and Indian heritage, Tyagarajan was born in Karlsruhe in the southwest of Germany, but spent many vacations in the United States. An accomplished pianist, he played his first public recital at the age of 8. In his 20s, he founded and directed Kammermusik Kurs in Dortmund, a successful chamber music academy and festival. Tyagarajan's higher education took place in the US. He received both his bachelor's and master's degrees in music from Indiana University and a doctorate of musical arts from the University of Maryland. Tyagarajan comes to Symphony in C from the Rochester Philharmonic, where he was the senior director of artistic operations and education. During his tenure there, he was credited with significant contributions to artistic planning, finance, education, and audience development. When I spoke with Krishna Tyagarajan earlier this week, I first asked him what factors had convinced him that the Symphony in C presidency was right for him.
It seemed like an opportunity too good to be true, coming at a time when I was ready for this type of opportunity. It really allows me to pair my interest in artistic administration. I have that entrepreneurial streak in me. And at the same time, there's a very large education outreach component to this orchestra, which as a former faculty member and as a musician is also very, very important to me. And I think that combination makes Symphony in C extremely attractive to me.
What did they say to you in the interview that convinced you that this was the job for you? Or when you looked around, what did you see as the prospects for Symphony in C?
That's a dangerous question, but I think without hesitation, the one thing that really clinched it for me was the music director, Russin Milanov, after the interview during a dinner, said to one of the board members, "You know, Krishna really gets it because he has that combination of a musician and an administrator. And when you have that kind of trust from your music director, you can pretty much do anything because you don't need to talk about basics anymore. Both of us think along the same lines." And then in addition to that, the staff is just really phenomenal. I mean, this is an organization that's not very large, but people really take care of business in a very excellent way. And there's a very dedicated board behind it, too. And then, for me personally, the most important thing is the programming. They can do things that, for instance, some of the legacy orchestras really can't do.
Such as?
Well, you can have this new composers element where you can have young composers. We have a competition, and they submit pieces every year, and we choose the best pieces, and we can program these in our subscription series, which probably a legacy orchestra would have to think twice about taking a young, untested composer in some ways and putting them on their subscription series because they're thinking about 2,000 seats of a hall to fill, and it's a whole different kind of a mission. And, of course, we pair it like, for instance, the concert tonight will pair Andrew McPherson, a young composer, and his piece called Interstate Holiday, with some of the tried and tested repertoire, Tchaikovsky's Fourth Symphony, which I think everybody loves, and Prokofiev's Second Piano Concerto, which is a personal favorite of mine. And it's that combination of doing what you know, doing what you love, and trying things that you may not know, and giving people a chance that makes this, I think, a special type of orchestra.
Symphony in C, the Haddonfield Symphony, as it was previously known, has gone through massive changes, massive positive changes over the last 3 or 4 years. What's good about it, and what more is there to do, to your mind, having been here for just a short time?
The challenge that I see, first and foremost, is something that has to do with name recognition. There was a rebranding, and it was done, I think, rather well. But there are still certain things that need to be done in the future to really establish this name on a more regional basis. We want to have much more recognition for Symphony in C as to what it really is. And when I say that, it's because in recent conversations, I've had people come up to me and say, oh, you're the president of that youth orchestra. Well, we're not a youth orchestra. We have young professionals playing with us. These are people who finished their studies or are about to finish their studies at graduate level. These are people who, within a few years, become concert masters, become principal players in the leading orchestras, not just of the United States, but we just had one of our musicians go to Cologne to be in that orchestra. So overseas, we're supplying musicians from our orchestra, too. And we need to make sure that Symphony in C stands for that level of quality, for dynamic young professionalism. And there's still a ways to go to make sure everybody knows that.
Is the model for that then the New World Symphony, which would be probably the best known of the type of orchestra that, that Symphony in C is?
New World Symphony is certainly one of the models that we would look at. Obviously, New World Symphony is a $150 million orchestra, I think, somewhere around that range. But through my wife and my brother, and actually I myself have played with them, I do know that they run a wonderful operation down there. The Symphony in C, in some ways, doesn't need to replicate the quality because we already have that. So we're fine with that. Symphony in C does not have South Beach as one of its assets, which New World Symphony obviously has. Symphony
oh,
in
I
C,
don't know. The Camden waterfront has its charm, surely.
I think in a few years, I think maybe we'll be having a much different picture. And of course, there's a lot of development that has happened over the last few years.
So what's it about now? Just keeping the orchestra in place, keeping it healthy?
Well, everybody, I think, across the country right now is really about keeping your orchestra in place and keeping it healthy. Symphony in C, on the other hand, has had a very stable history. We are not suffering some of the same woes that, for instance, the Philadelphia Orchestra is suffering, and certainly not in that dimension. But the economy has softened, and you have to be honest and say that everybody feels that. So what it's about now is putting structures in place that ensure that we have a vibrant future, and I think we're on a good way doing that. It's about making sure that the region at large knows who we are, and then attracting the investors that help us get to that next step where we can really become a nationally known entity in the classical music world.
Are you brave enough to put a time span on all of these big plans?
Well, I personally have a 3-year plan, a 5-year plan, and a 10-year plan. But having grown up in Germany and having grown up in West Germany, I'm also painfully aware that East Germans had 5-year socialist plans, and most of them didn't turn out. So I think it would be a little bit dangerous to reveal all of that. But with Symphony in C, in the next 3 years, there will be more collaboration with existing arts organizations across the greater Philadelphia area and also into the New York City area. And that is something that we can do very quickly. We're working on projects right now, most of which I can't really divulge yet. But there will be some victory celebrations in the near future because a number of these projects are ready to go, basically.
Krishna Tyagarajan, the new president of Symphony in C. The orchestra plays its first subscription concert of the season at Rutgers Camden Center for the Arts this evening. The performance will be broadcast on WRTI in November. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony in C under music director Rossin Milanov. Eric Brannan is our associate producer. The show's executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.